We have just come through a bruising election and a singularly partisan period of our history, and I think if I can have my first two slides, they will be in honor of the person I would put my voice down as saying is the most significant artist of his generation, that's Felix Gonzalez-Torres. If we can have the first slide. Do I just by myself? Ah, such power. Now if we can have the lights come down a little bit. Anyway, we have come through this election, and as usual, it has been followed after everybody called each other all the names they could possibly think of and invented a few by the call for bipartisan action, accompanied by the usual signs of hardening positions and factionalism, that is to say, hardening positions within both sides and factionalism internally, which makes me think that this is a particularly good time to talk about pluralism and its mechanisms and perhaps some of its costs, but also many of its benefits. In politics, polarization becomes a necessary part of activity for some people, but it also becomes possible simply because it allows one to project one's own internal divisions onto somebody else. The things that may be wrong with you turn out to be wrong of somebody else, the other side, and you conquer your own disagreements with yourself by conquering them. The polarization of art is also a factor in art history. In the early phases of modernism, which were rife with absolutisms, we had isms to begin with and manifestos beyond that. I'm just going to show you. This is two Felix Gonzalez-Torres pieces. All of his pieces were untitled, but this was called Untitled the Reagan Years. And that was, I forget what it's called untitled, but it has some kind of political connotation because it's actually the red, white, and blue, and they're candies you can eat. This is just to, again, on this sort of American theme because of the season, two versions of the idea proposed by the man who made the one on the far side, Jasper Johns, that if one makes images of things he said the mind already knows, it's amazing what comes up. In fact, how many things we do not know about them, how many extra resonances and different dimensions that they actually acquire. So famously, Jasper made this painting in the mid to late 50s. He made a group of them. And they were at that time deemed absolutely and totally subversive, such that when Alfred Barr wanted to acquire one for the Museum of Modern Art, he had to persuade Philip Johnson to buy it for him and sit on it, keep it on ice, until in the recent aftermath of the McCarthy era, it would be possible to show such a painting as not being an outrageous slap in the face at the waving flag, because of course this one doesn't wave a bit. It is absolutely rigid. And it is undergirded also by newspapers so that you have this wonderful sort of dense sediment of the daily life of the Republic overlaid by this very fleshy version of the American flag. Anyway, that's what Jasper did many years ago. This is one of my favorite slides of recent years, something I tried and failed to acquire for the modern, a piece by Kim Dingell, which is based on a series of maps of the United States made by kids in Las Vegas High School where she taught. This is what the mind already knows, but sort of doesn't know the same way ever in any cases. This is what America means to me. I'm not sure that's the Frank Sinatra song, but it's something like that. Anyway, again, little bits of patriotism. This, by the way, a little bit more. These are other parts of America. These are other great painters who dealt with the vicissitudes, and particularly with the internal contradictions of Americans. Leon Golub on the far side, and on the near side, Philip Guston. Artists of roughly the same generation, artists of very different ways of approaching the same problems, which is an America at war with itself, or at war with others, and therefore conflicted about its own relationships to itself. And famously, Guston, of course, made this happen by assuming the guise of the Ku Klux Klansman, when in fact he was anything but, and imagining what it would be like to roam the horizon in a very difficult time, the Nixon years. As a Ku Klux Klansman, Leon Golub, who reflected on the American use of surrogates in the wars that they fought overseas. And just to end this little political digression, but just to say that political art doesn't necessarily come with a message. It comes only, again, with the contradictions built into it. On the near side, a piece not at all political, but it can show you how different things look in different contexts. This is Mauricio Catalan, and I don't have the title with me, but it's something about wanting to be loved. And on the far side, a piece, a leftover of the Cold War called Them and Us. Now, I will use them and us as the point to turn on my heel slightly and come back to the larger themes. The idea of them and us is powerful in art history, as I say, in particular moments where people write manifestos declaring what art ought to be from their point of view. And they also tend to ally these ought-to-bes with a series of other justifications that buttress the ought-to-be, usually philosophical, often political. And much of the problem of dealing with modern art, modernism in all of its different forms, is that many of these ought-to-bes conflict. They conflict rather dramatically with one another. In fact, sometimes they actively are at war with one another. It is impossible to entertain the idea that all of these ought-to-be, ought-to-have-been, without understanding that basically you will therefore sacrifice one or the other to one or the other in order to have your way with art, with history, etc., etc., etc. One of the things I think of sometimes is the faculty meeting at the Soviet Academy in Vitebsk, where Kandinsky, Chagall, and Malevich would have argued about what ought to be. On the other hand, we are very grateful that we have the work of all of them to hang in our museums, and that the arguments can take place, in a sense, in front of us, and in other cases, there are no arguments at all. They are simply amazing works of art. So the them and us dichotomy is something that is built into the way modernism has been structured, but it is also the problem that one must overcome in order to actually deal with the varieties of art. Which is not to blame it on the artists, because after all, in situations where you have an extremely conservative, established idea of what art is, you have to use a battering ram to get through. In other cases, where there are a dozen peoples with battering rams, you better have the biggest battering ram to get through. So that the idea of isms is about a natural conflict of ideas which takes place, but what matters is those conflict of ideas don't necessarily win or lose, as to produce embodiments of what they might represent, what their complexities of understanding of the world are, that are there for us to think about long after the battle among them is over, long after the circumstances that produced that battle has morphed into some other circumstance. Now, the place where isms tend to fight most is where there's the most power. In the 19th century, that was France, and Paris, as Walter Benjamin famously declared it, was the capital of the 19th century. In the mid-20th century, it was the United States, and Clement Greenberg, Harold Rosenberg, and a host of other people declared that what happened in New York was what mattered most. And Greenberg in particular created an idea that he called the mainstream, which was a way of describing how it was that the greatness of the consolidated European traditions, which, as we know, were not consolidated. The greatness of the consolidated European traditions flowed naturally, and we know nothing about art is natural since everything about it is, by definition, artificial, how they naturally flowed through New York to create a new art world. Now, if you look outside at John Baldessari's exhibition, which is a wonderful thing, I just got a little taste of it coming in, but just remember that John is one of those artists who did not make $1 million at his first auction, who probably didn't have a first auction until he was in his 50s, who has worked on the West Coast for a long time. He is, by the way, also one of those artists who disproves the notion that those who do, do, and those who can't teach, since he is one of the great teachers and artists that we have, and incidentally has gone back to teaching well past the point where there is any economic necessity for it. I would say that another artist, which is well represented in this collection, Wei Tebo, is another example of this. And altogether, the role of teaching artists in California is more akin to that of teaching artists in Germany, like Beuys and others, than it is in New York, which is to tell you a little bit about how different art worlds actually are and how little mainstream there is that really actually describes them all. But in any case, let me get the next slide. In any case, the idea of the mainstream conveniently covered up all the ways in which the conflicts of art in the early phases were manifest. All the ways in which people actually didn't choose either or, they did and. And they did the and not only within groups, but within themselves, such that the first great modernist by most accounts, Picasso, was contradicting himself within about 7 years of having invented cubism, and contradicts himself avidly, if you will, almost entirely in the next 10. 1914 is the date of the first neoclassical picture that he made, and Demoiselle d'Avignon is what, 1907. This is, of course, Women by the Well. Both belong to the Museum of Modern Art. And to go to the Museum of Modern Art and not read the disturbances in the field that these two pictures represent, and not read the arguments with himself, Norman Mailer did advertisements for himself, Picasso did arguments with himself. In any case, not to read the arguments himself is to miss actually the substance of modern art. This is one example. Here's another, two paintings by Francis Picabia, who, in a funny kind of way, has become one of the most influential artists of the last two decades, although the most unexpected influential artist. It was commonly said that if indeed Picasso was the great painter of the first half of the 20th century, then Duchamp was the great artist of the 20th century because he undid virtually everything that Picasso represented. Picabia has had some great last innings. And as a fellow traveler in early Dada with Duchamp, it's interesting that what he did was he devoted those last innings, and all of his innings mostly, to painting. He took the same perversities that Duchamp had, but he applied them to the problem of making interesting paintings which more or less belied their own value. He was deeply cynical, which is a reminder that great artists can be cynical and that great art sometimes is cynical, and that when we use cynical in the least serious use of that word, that is to say kind of cheap scorn, rather than as a critical device for calling into question not only somebody else's pieties but our own, then you can understand the ways in which Picabia is, in a time where there have been altogether too many pieties, a remarkably tempting figure for a lot of young artists. For those of you who may not know this, take one example. Philip Perlstein, the American realist painter, known for painting very sober nudes under very unforgiving light, is often thought by conservatives to be representative of a kind of solid, direct, observational painting of the kind that we, meaning they, respect. Philip Perlstein actually was a graduate student at the Institute of Fine Arts, where I have taught until recently. Actually, I still teach there. And while at the Institute of Fine Arts, he wrote a dissertation, or a master's paper, actually, on Picabia, and on particularly the perversities of Picabia. And if you look at Philip's recent paintings, you will find all kinds of Picabia-esque anomalies and contradictions of imagery creeping into what people thought were safe realist paintings and that other people thought were boring realist paintings. So in any case, he's a good example. Just parallel on that, since I'm being a little digressive all across the board, the other great graduate student of the Institute of Fine Arts, who spent not a few years as Philip did, but six, was Ad Reinhardt. And he too was a wonderful satirist. And in as much as he made some of the most sublime abstract paintings any painter has made in this country, he made some of the most scathing political and art political cartoons that anybody has ever done either. So the spirit of I don't know what you would call it, is a kind of a spoiler spirit or a trickster spirit resides even in the most sober-seeming or most somber-seeming artists. And of course then, therefore, the relative tricksterism of somebody like Picabia is relative only. That it should be, for example, a model of not only Sigmar Polka, in whom one can see it rather obviously, but also in Gerhard Richter, who one cannot, is an indication exactly of how those little communities of strangeness attract. This is another version of the same art historical problem. On the far side, Theo van Doesburg, and on the near side, Baltus. How can you keep both of these artists in your mind at the same time? But the problem is that the images are very powerful, and once seen, one can't get them out of their mind. So they come to coexist de facto, even though logic or conviction may wish one or the other would go away. Or these. These are two images that represent, again, a kind of basic understanding of positive values in American art. As many people may not know, but is true, the first painting that the Museum of Modern Art ever purchased was this Edward Hopper that's right next to me. So it did not start with Picasso and Matisse, it started with an American painter, Hopper. On the far side, you have Walker Evans, and there is, if you read his biography, nobody stranger than Walker Evans. But he made these wonderfully empathetic pictures of a kind of straightforward American moment of the Depression era. But then I've been cheating because, of course, what I'm showing you is actually not Walker Evans. It's Sherry Levine's copy of Walker Evans. And so all the authenticities in the photograph, at least conceptually, should have dissolved before your very eyes. Or this. This is the mainstream, and I have gotten Greenberg on stage, so let's give him his moment. The idea of mainstream was that, as I said, that the great traditions would, in a continuous flow, give supremacy to American art henceforth. And so basically, you have all of the strands of early modern art, Picasso, Surrealism, Matisse, et cetera, flowing into Jackson Pollock. And once you have Jackson Pollock, you have that great American tradition, and all it needs now is to issue from its original statement, and it would therefore do the work of continuity all by itself. It is, of course, is again, one of the problems of this is that the source for Jackson Pollock was not primarily Matisse and Picasso and others, although Picasso did matter. It was primarily painters that Greenberg himself loathed, and many people had turned their back on, like Orozco and Siqueiros. So when you look at this picture and you see the grand continuity with Europe, you should certainly make at least allowances for a huge detour through Mexico City. Leftist politics, and a whole lot of other things like Thomas Hart Benton. And in any case, what Pollock represents is not the summum of a certain kind of natural evolution of modernism, but rather one of those precise examples where somebody who misunderstood the wrong people came up with the right art. And when I say misunderstood the wrong people, I don't think Orozco and Siqueiros were the wrong people, but I do think he misunderstood them. And I do think he came up with the right art. On the far side, a local artist of significance, and an international one as well, obviously Morris Lewis. How the drip becomes the stain, and so on, is the histories that are written into an American museum landscape, as far as you can see, although those of our generations are bitterly trying to enrich that writing without obliterating it. Here are two examples, for example, of what somebody has done with Pollock and with stain painting. On the far side, Sigmar Polka, in the spirit, if you will, of Picabia, and on the near side, Tip Dunham. And this, in this case, you have relief elements, which are, in fact, the sort of styrofoam balls you find at fun fairs. Now, these are both homages to that kind of art and send-ups of them at the same time, which is a reminder that if you have, on the one hand, truly good cynical art, you also can have some truly good insincere art that isn't cynical. And I will use as my authority on this Stravinsky, who said in his lectures at Harvard, he said, you know, most art is sincere and bad, but there is good insincere art that is sincerely good, or something on that order. Here again, the idea that one kind of art cancels another kind of art logically simply doesn't hold. There's a marvelous essay by Leo Steinberg called The Plight of the Public in Contemporary Art, in which he describes the ways in which his growing affection for Jasper Johns in the late 1950s threatened his deep devotion to abstract expressionism. How Johns's way of reframing the gesture, how Johns's way of evacuating the individual artist as protagonist of the picture, how Johns's Duchampian tendencies altogether and his amazing kind of reserve as an artist was exactly the undoing of a devotion to the idea of an authentic, purgative, direct statement, an expressionist statement. But the truth of the matter is that, as I say, you don't lose your love entirely. You may doubt some of the bases for it, but you retain the things that you were in love with in other forms, such that Roy Lichtenstein's version of the Johnsian gambit, which is to paint an utterly cold, predictable, graphic version of the free stroke, didn't make it impossible for de Kooning 20 years later to make some very good, very free strokes. Or this, just to give you some other possibilities. On the near side, colors for a large wall of Jasper Johns. On the far side, a heavily Duchamp-influenced Sherry Levine. She makes her second appearance. And this is a suite of Kellyisms. Now, I, again, love Kelly's work. I have loved it for a long time. There was a time when I had to love it almost secretly, because Kelly was understood to be an important American artist, but a little too French around the edges. Whereas Frank Stella and other American artists who were New York-defined entirely were the ones that were making history, and indeed, the Museum of Modern Art devoted two full exhibitions to the work of Frank Stella, who, by the way, again, if you look at the present situation and lament the fact that artists are too famous too young, remember that Johns was having his first major exhibition when he was in his early 30s, I think actually the age of 30, and that Frank had his first show when he was just graduated as an undergraduate from Princeton University. He was in the Museum of Modern Art collection and exhibition space. So there are fast starts and slow starts, and if Baldessari represents a glorious slow start, Frank and others represent glorious fast starts. Ellsworth is sort of in the middle. But in any case, if I put Ellsworth up here, it is only to say that his work holds up even when it is lampooned, even when it becomes the model for something utterly different than it, even when he is, in a sense, used as the foil for other things of their own value. So this is a sympathetic version of it. This is Richard Tuttle. And I unfortunately couldn't find the right slide for the Kelly piece in this case, but there are things that you will remember from memory that rhyme with this perfectly. So this is what happens when you remove the stretcher and when painting qua painting becomes something else because you're basically dealing with hemmed fabric. This is a reminder that no idea happens in isolation, that Ellsworth's enormously important contribution to the shaped canvas is not without parallel. And the parallel in this case is Lucio Fontana in Italy. And again, it wasn't a good thing to be a non-American artist in New York in the 50s and 60s, because although some of them appeared and were shown, Bowie and others, Dubuffet and others, they were always seen at a discount. It was always Dubuffet is good, but not as good as Pollock, or something like that. But in any case, Fontana is one of those artists who everybody now sees with fresh eyes because for so long he, in fact, was kept at arm's distance by people who were hung up on the mainstream. But he also does something that in his shaped canvas is very different from what Kelly does, which is that he perforates it, he cuts into it. And by the way, this is a marvelous instance of where slides lie. They all lie, but they really lie here because the big painting on the far side you can scale to the baseboard. This particular painting is about that high. So that when we're dealing with vocabularies of similarity, it's the differences that make all the difference. Or this. Again, we have on the far side a work of Ellsworth Kelly. On the near side, we have a work by the young artist Tom Friedman, something that I show in the Projects Gallery at the Museum of Modern Art, a marvelous rectilinear abstraction made of iPenna toothpaste. And you could smell it for blocks. Now, again, I said I like easy pleasures. There's something a little disconcerting about a toothpaste pleasure, because it's the pleasure you wake up in the morning, but it cloys very quickly. And so the Duchampian, Picabian aggression in this painting is it's too much of a nice thing in every possible way. And of course, being toothpaste, it never really dries either. So if you rub your shoulder against it, it sort of comes off. Anyway, so again, this is just a place of games. Or this, two Kellys. Mike and Ellsworth. How could one like Mike Kelly and Ellsworth Kelly? This was one of the first people I thought about as antitheses that I find interesting that other people find difficult. Now, the reality is that the market tends to validate these things after a while, right? When two strong categories of taste meet in the auction room or in the gallery, the one that was absolutely anathema becomes tolerable simply because it is equally expensive. And that is the way things find themselves into living rooms and into museums, as I will shortly show you. Now, I am not a Friedman-type guy. I do not believe in the virtues of the market, and I am not saying this in irony because he has just recently died, although he was a neighbor of ours in Chicago when my sister and I were growing up. But in any case, the market does have some functions. It puts into play in ways that other structures might forbid. It puts into play opposites that at least allows you, or at least in fact forces you, to entertain them in your mind at the same time. So here we have the two Kellys. And you can see, in fact, that if you want to measure it by one of my standards, which is wall power, that they both have it. That the Kelly holds its own, that is the Kelly left, holds its own with the Kelly right, even though it violates every tenet of the Kelly right. And the Kelly right holds its own with the Kelly left. It does not go away because this Kelly just showed up. Again, I have probably a stronger affinity in some ways with Ellsworth Kelly in terms of my pleasure, and probably a stronger affinity in terms of my nature with Mike. So this is a debate within me that I find interesting to see played out by two different artists, both of whom who do their work marvelously well. This is what I wanted to show you in terms of the business of how the market operates and how the museum operates. Here again, we're dealing with works of art rather than pictures of works of art. Both of these are photographs by the American artist Louise Lawler. On the far side is the Emily and Burton Tremain collection at home. And you can see, this is one of my very favorite slides, and if you've had a lecture from me before, you may have seen it before, because in cases where something in the order of what I'm going to talk about comes up, it seems to be the appropriate one. But here you have a glorious Tondo painting by Robert Delaunay in the back, from I don't know the exact date, but I would imagine about 1967, something like that. You have a Roy Lichtenstein pop art lamp on the table, and you have Stevie Wonder on the box. This is all of contemporary culture, and it is in its domestic form. And it is interesting that people who have the means are quite comfortable having disparateness around them in this manner. But they sometimes then venture out into other circumstances where, if challenged on an exhibitions committee, a trustee committee for collections, in a lecture situation, they may actually take positions harder than the ones represented by what they live with. I would all encourage you to take heart from the fact that Emily and Burton Tremaine were quite comfortable living with disparateness. I am jealous of them. I wish I could too. But except for that, I think it is a very good example of how it is the learning process of collecting, where you acquire things without trading away the things you had previously acquired, that develops a complex consciousness of art and a complex way of relating to it. And if only we could sit in an armchair, as Matisse imagined, and just look at the picture at the end of a busy day, knowing, of course, that unlike Matisse's model, some of those pictures may not be entirely comforting. On the near side, of course, is the Tremaine collection in a museum. And museums are, as I think, Bill Lieberman once said, very often collections of collectors, or at least collections of the collections that collectors made. A good museum is more than that, but almost no museum is not that in some measure. And the disparateness of these collections mean, therefore, you have the individual contradictions of the primary collector mixed with the individual contradictions of the next collector and the next collector and the next collector, all of them orchestrated by the contradictions of the curators who must hang them. And what it does is it creates a wonderful sort of visually cacophonous dialogue of multiple personalities. If we know anything about postmodernism, is that we are not unified beings. Postmodernism has given license for us to talk to ourselves in tongues, so to speak. And works of art give us the occasion to do that. In any case, these are more or less what I wanted to talk about in that regard. Here now is the second example, but I'll stop. That in relation to the museum traditions, the person who did this absolutely the best was Alfred Barr. And in many cases, the idea of the modern as this oppressive institution devoted to a streamlined, exclusive version of art history is a myth based on its second great epic, and it was a great epic, when Bill Rubin, who was a Greenbergian, streamlined that collection and put large parts of it in the closet. But Barr's version of modern art was all the many things that he thought were of interest in the present tense. And I'll come back to it in a minute. But Barr's version of modern art is much closer to the Tremaine collection than it is to anything that one finds in textbooks of modern art, which are based on this model of a logical progression from one thing to the next, a supersession of one idea by another. It is rather that art, because ideas do not supersede each other, because they phase in and phase out and come up again when repressed, that art history becomes so interesting. Now, if I sing Barr's praises and those of some collectors of this type, I will sing in particular that of one critic and artist, Donald Judd. Donald Judd is associated with the most severe kind of American minimalist art. And it is also thought that that kind of art was, in the ideologically driven kind of art making, absolutely exclusive of other kinds of art, that only the purity of one form, the cube, for example, could be dealt with, and everything else was an absolutely impossible to tolerate impurity. But the great thing about Judd was that he wasn't that way at all, in fact. He had, in art historical terms, a roving eye. In art historical terms, I say because he was, in fact, partially trained as an art history. He was a student of Meyer Shapiro's. He had been a philosophy student prior to that at Columbia. And he had a critical and expansive mind. Now, if his eye was roving, it didn't mean it was any less discriminating. It saw a great deal and judged it very, very severely. A couple of the artists I'm going to show in this slide review are artists that he panned thoroughly, where I disagree with him on his pan. But what I want to point out to is something else, that the artist who, for many people, would be made for the white cube and made for a very streamlined version of art history was also among the first people to spot and the most generous in criticizing artists that for many years were pushed out of the mainstream and are only now coming back. For example, to the left, Yayoi Kusama. that every museum is now pursuing, who is now having exhibitions in her late 70s, if I'm not mistaken, that are making waves. An artist who comes from a different culture, who works in an idiom which has many attributes in common with Louise Bourgeois, and was therefore disturbing to people for somewhat the same reasons. In any case, Judd was the first person to write seriously about Kusama, and just to sort of talk about the hidden layers of the mainstream, Frank Stella was one of the first people to buy her. So that out of the collections of Judd and Stella now come some of the best Kusamas we can find. These two are artists that Donald Judd admired. H.C. Westerman on the far side, whose exhibition was here, and who was long thought of as a mere regional talent of interest. Who Judd thought and said was one of the best artists we have anywhere today at the time of writing the essay. Or on the near side, Lee Bontekou, who again was an artist of interest to people for a while, a New York school artist, in fact. This is a case of somebody who was right in the right place but doing the wrong thing. So she was had her moment, if you will, in the hierarchy. In Hugo Mullis's book, The New Art Scene in New York, she appears along with Chamberlain, Stella, and a host of others. But for a host of reasons, she also then disappeared and was very hard to bring back into the fold. And the exhibition practice of a number of people has done that finally. This was the most surprising late entry in Judd's pluralistic approach, and that was Ilya Kabakov. The Russian conceptual artist who was the last person, I believe, invited by Judd himself to come and make a permanent installation in Marfa. And the idea that a Russian conceptual artist who was nothing if not literary, when it was thought that mainstream American art was nothing if not anti-literary, should be the person that Judd would fasten on to make a full-scale permanent installation equivalent to that of all of the other figures of the New York School, Oldenburg, Flavin, and others that have situations at Marfa. Now, I'm going to change the slide menu a little bit and just put this up for a second. I'm trying to make an argument for pluralism on a simple basis. That basis is that we are, in fact, made of contradictions, and that if we do not acknowledge that we are made of contradictions, we can't be truthful about just about anything that we have to do with when it comes to art, not to mention other parts of our life. There is a wonderful, totally American version of this, or defense of this, offered by S. Scott Fitzgerald, where he says, the test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in the mind at the same time and still be able to retain the ability to function. Now, we tend to read theory these days, and theory talks about difference, but enforces sameness by its logic, by its rhetoric, by its way of making arguments. In literature, the doors are much more loosely ajar. And it's interesting that there are writers like Fitzgerald to whom one can go back to find out something interesting about difference with ourselves, that does not fall into the rhetorical vocabulary of postmodernist thinking, but allows for exactly the kind of internal pluralism that postmodernism at least should partially be about. Pluralism is not relativism. Pluralism does not mean that everything is equal to everything else. It means that everything has a value. The values may indeed be very unequal. They may be, in certain cases, also perfectly paired dialectically with things of equal value but contradictory, absolutely contradictory sense, in which case, rather than simply saying, I will have some of this and some of that, you can say, I will have large helpings of both, not only for the benefits they contain, but for the tensions that they naturally create. It is often thought that quality will determine how we judge art when we come to choices of this nature. But of course, quality is not a thing, and I am certainly not a Kantian. Quality is really to say qualities in the plural again. There are different qualities to different kinds of art, and there are different levels of complexity and achievement in every one of them. It makes no sense to compare the quality of one thing to the quality of something that has a whole different sense of what it is and why it is. One can only compare their degree of realization of those properties and possibilities inherent in them. And therefore, if you use the quality of Jackson Pollock to belie the quality of I don't know who, a contemporary painter of his generation, you are taking a great big risk. If you use, for example, the quality of Ellsworth Kelly to belie the quality of Lucio Fontana, you're missing the boat. If you can see the quality in both and understand the difficulties both had, the things both achieved, and the things they did not, one is in much surer territory. In this case, therefore, I would say connoisseurship, another value that is supposed to sort of settle matters, connoisseurship has to be carefully, delicately addressed. You cannot be a connoisseur in a dozen things. You can only be a connoisseur in those things to which you have sufficient access and for which you have sufficient time and interest to study. Now, that does not mean you cannot be connoisseur in disparate things, however. You can be an aficionado of Indian Rajput and Deccan and other kinds of painting and be very engaged in postmodern constructivist work or something like that. You can bridge vast territories, but you can't be an expert in all of them in between and all of the ones that go laterally. There's also another little problem which has to do with good taste in relation to bad taste. As I say, I'm no great believer in taste, and I'm no Kantian. But taste as a way of saying that one assesses, one weighs through a sort of acquired familiarity and an ability to make distinctions and to discriminate among examples, then good taste does not mean there is good taste and bad taste and that the objects associated with it are immediately identifiable in sort of a priori, but rather that there are people who have better abilities and people who have less good abilities relative to the object of study. And one of the great rebellions in modern art, from its very beginnings, with Picabia being the example, but in the 1970s and 60s, in the revolt against the American idea of the mainstream, it was pop and funk. The idea of good taste and bad taste meant, how do you have good taste in bad taste? And in the 1970s, this was pressed a little farther by the idea of bad painting, which went aggressively in the wrong way in relation to painting values that were thought to be mainstream. Guston, of course, is emblematic of this. Guston was the person who had the best taste among the abstract expressionists, so much the best taste that many people thought of him as a lightweight painter, consequently, who then began to develop his cartoon figures and was judged to have bad taste. But the people who didn't like him, he didn't even give credit for bad taste. They made him the person who had bad taste within bad taste. Hilton Kramer famously calling him a mandarin pretending to be a stumble bum. But that doesn't solve the problem. There is an artist, Neil Jenny, whose work I showed you at the very beginning, the two planes, the Soviet plane and the American plane, them and us in confrontation. And I did an interview with him some years ago, and he sort of broke it down in a much better way. He said, there is good painting and good drawing. There's bad painting and good drawing. There's good painting and bad drawing. And there's bad drawing and bad painting. His work, Jenny's work, would be a case of bad painting, figure painting, smearing, with very good drawing. There is, perhaps with Kelly, a case of bad painting and bad drawing. That is to say, both sides are awkward, but both sides are also eloquent in their awkwardness, and that is the whole point. And therefore, first we have to assume that there is not a dichotomy good and bad in taste, that there is capacity and incapacity in relation to both things, there is the ability to notice in both things, and then with any given artifact, there are multiple qualities to which that capacity can be applied, and you have to be a good judge of what the balances are and how artistically those balances have been chosen and either balanced or pitted against one another to create an object which, after all, if you hate it that much, got your attention. And if you hate it that much, flew under the radar of your taste and somehow tapped into one of your internal contradictions. Kelly and Koons are good examples of people who have good taste and bad taste. And they are people who show the ways in which this is not just a sort of fly-by-night Luddite or lumpen movement in art, but a continuation of the complex dialectics of modernism, which are founded on the principle that art shall reveal its own nature by exploring its own means. And what they have done is exploring it coming in backwards. They are, well, I won't go into the anatomical reference, but anyway. Another person one can look to in this context is Bertolt Brecht, who applied the principle of crude thinking to situations, the ways in which the best way to break up a deadlock of thought is to think crudely about it rather than more exquisitely. Or Martin Kippenberger, the late but until recently contemporary German artist, who reminded us that you can't be dumb to do dumb. Now, There are, in this context, all kinds of tensions, and I'm going to shift to another example and show you how, in working with artists, one sometimes comes up against the tension between two artists who have differing or divergent opinions of each other, and how, as a curator, one finds oneself in the middle. Here you have two paintings made in roughly the same year, 64-65. One is Uncle Rudy by Gerhard Richter. Maybe that's 66, actually. And on the far side, a painting heavily influenced by Mark Rothko, although about as big as that, by Robert Ryman. Two artists coming from entirely different backgrounds. Gerhard Richter coming from East Germany, having lived through the Nazi era, having been a socialist realist painter, and a successful one, by the way. And Bob Ryman, who started out as a jazz musician, never took any art lessons. Gerhard took a lot. Started out as a jazz musician and learned painting by doing on the side. He also worked as a Museum of Modern Art guard, which is where he fell in love with Rothko, simply by watching the installation of a Rothko show. Now, these two artists are both of them very important to me, and both artists with whom I have worked a great deal and who I know very well. But there's a very interesting relation between the two of them, and as a curator, one found oneself, or I found myself, between them. Which is to say that they both showed extensively in Germany in the early 1960s. Ryman was one of that group of artists, of which Richard Tuttle, Karl Andre, and others were examples, who had actually better reception in Europe in their early phases of their career than they had in their own country. And one of the projects of museum people in recent years is, in a sense, to recover the missing part of American art history, which is to say all of those artists who should have been in the mainstream but weren't, who are now being finally caught up with by the American public, and also who are finally being caught up with American art history, since that mainstream has to be entirely rewritten if one is to deal with it at all, by incorporating them fully. Thus, Frank Stella is a remarkable painter, but he's not the only kid on the block, and it's not just Ellsworth Kelly who is there with him. But in any case, these are two artists who showed in the same context, who are of roughly the same age. In fact, I think they're identical age. And the problem is something like this. Gerhard Richter loves Ryman's work, has always loved Ryman's work, partly because Ryman does the thing that he, Gerhard Richter, cannot do. Gerhard Richter is a deeply skeptical man, a seriously skeptical man, who does not feel that it is in him, or perhaps in the times, to make transcendent paintings, who does not feel that it is him or in the times to deal in simple terms with the material nature of painting, who is anti-positivist, not that Ryman is a positivist, but who is in all kinds of ways a philosophical painter in the ways that Ryman is a painter with philosophical weight but not philosophical intention, if you want to put it that way. In any case, Richter has always admired Ryman. Ryman has never known until recently what to do with Richter. He could not understand the diversity of styles. He could not understand whether indeed he was sincere about his work, and for Bob that is a value. And altogether he felt uncomfortable even though he understood his force. It was, I'll show you these two. Again, these are contemporary paintings, as are these. Two paintings from 1988, one from the Bader-Meinhof series, October 1977, which I bought for the Modern. On the far side, a painting which I wish I could have bought for the Modern, of Bob Ryman's, also from 1988. At the Richter exhibition, to which Bob was invited because all artists who have had retrospectives at the Modern come to those events, he walked through the galleries and his eyes were opened for the first time to what Richter was as a painter. Since Bob's priorities are on painting, he has said over and over and over again, he said, there has never been a question of what to paint, but only how to paint. And Richter, conversely, has always, in a sense, thought there is always the question of what to paint and by what right one paints it, even though the how can be as many possible ways as you could imagine. And the discovery of Ryman, by Ryman of Richter at this exhibition, was one of those situations where people who normally could not have come to terms, in effect, did come to terms. And it was after that, actually, that Bob had a retrospective in Bonn and that Gerhard and I went in at very high speeds in a BMW, as you can only do in Germany, to go see the Ryman show. And it was interesting to walk through the Ryman exhibition and look at it, not with my own eyes, which I've been looking at Ryman since the early 1970s, but with his eyes, and to see how it is that that which was familiar to me was interestingly estranged and then reacquired, if you will, through Ryman, through Richter's experience. Now, I'm going to just show, these are just pairings. These are cases of pseudomorphism. a term which basically says that things that look alike are alike, except, of course, we know that if things look alike, they're not alike. The difference is built into similarity as well as being obvious when things are extremely various and diverse. So here you have Marcel Duchamp's installation for the Surrealism show of, I think, 1940 about in New York. And on the near side, you have Eva Hesse's Right After. Excuse me, Hang Up. No, excuse me, it's Right After. Now, I'm just going to go through some slides and just say a few simple things, and then I will get in under my hour, and you can go wherever you need to go. Although, I'll say I'd be happy to respond to challenges, respond to questions, whatever, later on. Anyway, these are some artists I have found that I'm interested in, despite the fact that I try, in some ways, to fend some of them off, or have tried to fend some of them off. But I learned something from my own experience of exposure, something that's connected to what I just said, which is if something really irritates you, that it has identified a node in your consciousness. The things that don't interest me are things that just are blandly okay. They can be expensively okay, they can be brilliantly okay, they can be beautifully okay, but they're just okay. Things that are really not okay, or things that are really exceptional in some other ways, are the ones that I understand to have identified something that is a potential in me. It may be a potential I would prefer not to discuss with my family and friends, but it is a potential. And one should know about these things and explore them, and one of the things about art is that one can. In this respect, I'd like to say two things. In terms of the role of a professional in this matter, what does somebody who has espoused what I've espoused here do against the charge that one has a public responsibility to choose the best, not to pollute the culture with dubious things, not to foist off your own little quirky favorites on people who have less time to devote to this and should not be led astray or should not be given trifling things one way or another? There is some truth of this. And there are indeed trivial exhibitions made all the time. There are distracting exhibitions all made all the time. But you can tell the difference between one which you don't like, as I said, liking being not a very interesting term, one which you don't like, which is made sincerely or insincerely, in order to say this exists. And if you will give it the time, you will get something back from it. And in relation to this, I would simply like to quote a model given to me by Rona Rube, who was Alfred Barr's last major assistant before his full departure from the museum, and who was for many years thereafter the archivist of the Museum of Modern Art. She recalled talking to Barr at one point where he said he thought the role of the museum director, or museum curator, excuse me, was to operate like the big city editor, like the editor of a big city paper, that the decisions that the editor makes is what to print. And also in what form it appears. Does it appear as news, or does it appear a reportage, or does it appear with editorial content? Does it appear with deep analysis, or does it appear as a kind of notification that such and such is there? The idea that what museums should do is that they should bring the general public into the level of information that people who are specialists have, which is what reporters do, that it should open up a public dialogue and become a forum for ideas rather than an exponent of a theory of what those ideas should end up being or what things, where culture should end up going, is a very different model than the model of the mainstream, which is again why I think the Barr model of the museum director and museum curator is infinitely preferable to all those versions of the director and curator that we inherited from Clement Greenberg. And the fact that people have changed their ideas and no longer support color field painting but believe the text and grainy photographs are truth above all else, makes no significant difference. The idea of an open, pluralistic, eclectic, what have you, view of the world, which is at the same time dialectical and not relativistic, is what I am hoping to propound or to hold forth. And I will use again Judd as an example of an artist who did this. Or in a simple other variation of this is, let me give you some others. Here are two people who question painting all in making it, Daniel Buren on the far side, and on the near side, Gerhard Richter's very close friend, Brinkley Palermo. The point is that neither of these are really paintings. One of them is awning material, standard awning material, and the one on the near side is the so-called Stoffbilder, which is basically a painting made out of yard goods. These have all the attributes of what we would think of as a certain kind of hardcore modernist painting. But in fact, they are Duchampian gestures, but also they're not just Duchampian gestures because they are also really paintings. And the idea that when Duchamp trumps one thing, the other thing rolls up and goes away is not true. What happens is that every Duchampian gesture has also bred its own genre of the thing that it was in part intended to satirize. And Buren and Blinky Palermo and others are examples of this. Incidentally, here again, Kelly comes up as a very, very prescient artist because he made in about 1950 also a painting out of pure stretched fabrics with no painting whatsoever. Or these two artists, last year's fall season at MoMA and this year's fall season at MoMA. Artists who like and respect each other very much, but could not be further apart from each other in some dimensions, quite literally in three dimensions, but at the same time also feed off the same traditions of cubism and surrealism in order to create an extension of the modernist tradition, but in particularly the case of Elizabeth Murray, an extension which could not in any way be foreseen by the theories of the mainstream. For a host of reasons I won't go into here. Or just for, again, pseudomorphism for fun, Joan Mitchell and Joseph Beuys. I don't think they show up together very often. But if you actually look at the way this kind of swelling, flexing, but loosely so, a kind of geometry appears, it's interesting to see that they're actually not so far apart. And I, at least, again, I do have a secret life as a painter, and I have looked at both of these and wondered, I wonder how I could do that better. Two artists dealing with the same subject, and you could throw Richter in on this one as well, war planes. On the near side, Roy Lichtenstein again, and on the far side, V.S. Selmans. Roy Lichtenstein was in the army, but V.S. Selmans was underneath bombs. These two paintings represent different understandings of the image and therefore different vocabularies. To speak of them together is to tease out those differences rather than to compare them invidiously one to the other for superiority. Or this, I think kind of fun. The American painter Alex Katz, who has made painting after painting after painting of his very beautiful wife, Ada Katz, who is beautiful in part because she is so supremely intelligent in every painting. She's the last thing you would think of in terms of the passive female model. She's everything but. And yet he has reinvented the idea of the female muse by using this utterly urbane American figure. And on the far side, you have Jim Nutt, Midwestern painter, who has taken the vocabulary of, among others, John Graham, of Miro, and others, and to make another version of American womanhood. Now, I'm not going to get into the gender politics of this right now. Somebody may want to with me later. But suffice it to say that both of these artists are conservative artists in terms of what they do. Both of them make fresh and thought-provoking paintings. Or this, just in terms of legs and detachment, Susan Rothenberg on the far side and Bob Gober on the near side. I have said this also before, but I'll risk saying it again. The Gober is often underestimated, if you will, in terms of how provocative it is. It is, of course, a gesture in space, an absurd gesture in space. If anybody knows the famous Beauty and the Beast film of Cocteau, there are those wonderful sconces with arms that hold candelabras, and when Beauty and the Beast walk down the hall, these beautiful arms move. Okay? So in one way, this is a Cocteauian or surrealist gesture. The way in which it is not is, as most people don't notice until they're right on top of it, you're on the inside seam of this man's pants. Other contradictions. Contradictions in relation to craft. It was long thought that crudeness was authenticness, that craft was a sign of a kind of inauthentic preoccupation with effect, of mere decorative beauty, of mere luxury, if you will, of materials. But here you have two artists for whom the idea of exceedingly high levels of craft are essential and the intention behind it almost diametrically opposed. Martin Puryear on the near side and Jeff Koons on the far side. Martin Puryear, who does this himself, and Jeff Koons, who farms it out. To think about not the image per se, but this relation to craft and to the idea of what it means to truly make something in relation to a whole tradition of modern art for which fabrication or sort of improvised methods of making were the preferred mode, both of these artists challenge it. Both of them also, in a sense, are advocating a conservative, quote-unquote, position in relation to the avant-garde, now dated avant-garde, idea of the opposite, but they are thought-provoking to me at any rate because they do. This is one of my, again, favorite kinds of things. This is another case of an olfactory delight. These are two simple spheres, ideal pure forms. The one on the far side is made out of I don't know how many sticks of bubblegum, chewed by Tom Friedman, and then licked so that you can stick it to the wall. It also smells all over the gallery, just the way his toothpaste piece. The other one are two dumb balls. Let me go back to, you know, Kippenberger's, you can't be dumb to do dumb. Two dumb balls of David Ireland, the West Coast artist, who simply would take a lump of cement and toss it back and forth between his hands until it took the form of a perfect sphere. This is a platonic shape, basically. It is a Zen exercise. It is an absolutely beautiful form, but it, in a sense, means nothing other than its genesis, nothing other than the way it is to have that thing in your hand. Whereas the Friedman one is obviously satirical and other dimensions. In terms of the degradation of materials, or the idea of the A-form, which is very popular these days, on the far side, a photograph, which after all also is a work of art by Hans Namuth, of Jackson Pollock scattering paint, and the near side, Mike Kelly, doing a photograph shoot of the regression to childhood playing with one's feces. This is a satire on the part of Kelly of the idea of creative regression. What people don't understand with Kelly is that he too actually has a very critical attitude towards the myth of the unfettered artist. He's made works of art which are devoted to the idea that you explode the proposition that artists are like criminals, and that in a sense makes them the outlaw within the society and marvelous and romantic. He did this by creating a long corridor of faces with thinkers from Nietzsche to the classics and on up and down, saying things that equate the artist with the criminal. And at the end, he had a painting, dependent on the town, of a local serial killer incarcerated who had taken up Sunday painting, to point out the ways in which artists are not criminals, and criminals, in fact, are not artists. Therefore, when you look at the offense of this, in fact, is a critical activity addressed to the myth that goes with the idea that what Jackson Pollock was doing was finding his primal state. This is, again, two works of art, just to opposites attract, but this time the opposites attract by similarity. One is really de Kooning, and one is really, really not de Kooning, but really Sherry Levine. They're both actually pretty good drawings. Or this, another Mike Kelly. Scatological things seem to have me this evening. But this is a disorganized body. And on the near side, Nancy Rubens, who has made this marvelous sort of Baroque thing out of mattresses and expensive layer cakes. Or these, Alicia Skabich on the far side and Kara Walker on the near side. Artists who indulge in the grotesque. Now, a lot of what I've showed you is the grotesque, and I'm not going to go back in the next minute or two to my theories of the grotesque, but simply to say that the grotesque is where contradiction is the engine for art making, and that is why, as Thomas Mann said, it is peculiarly modern. This is a version of Beuys's felt suit, and this is Maurizio Cantillan having his fun with Beuys. And two other artists on the near side, Tom Friedman, on the far side, Charlie Ray, playing with the same type of situation. Here, Tom Noskowski, an abstract painter, and here, Jim Nutt, a realistic painter, or not a realistic painter, but an image painter, dealing in the same vocabulary, but doing utterly different things with it. Or here, this is, by the way, a lampoon. You'll see it says Yale on his t-shirt there. This is the lampoon of mainstream painting by Peter Saul. And on the far side, Jasper Johns, who has become a mainstream painter, quoting Picasso, who is the source of the mainstream, in something that's every bit as funky as the Saul. And this is the blank, and I will just say the last two remarks, or three. I've tried with examples and with arguments to basically advocate the notion that one should, in fact, look out, seek out art that is antithetical or seems to be antithetical, incommensurable or seems to be so. One should remember in the matters of taste that as much as taste matters, appetite matters. I am not interested in the taste of people who have no appetite. People who have appetites tend to eat things that are good for them and bad for them. They tend to eat more than they actually need, but they also tend to learn something from the experience. That in the world that we're dealing with, people with fastidious taste and small appetites tend to move very fast because they can give out certainties, but sooner or later, people with uncertain taste but big appetites will find their advice unsatisfying. I will simply argue that you will cut your losses and save time if you listen to people who have appetites similar to your own, and I'm thinking of it in magnitude, not necessarily particular things, and tastes dissimilar to your own. I will also then pick one last example. The last example is to cite scripture from my point of view, which is to cite Walt Whitman. Now, a lot of theoretical discourse, as I say, is now borrowed from German and French philosophical traditions, all of them very interesting, borrowed from philosophy and the social sciences, linguistics, et cetera, et cetera. But literature, and indeed American literature, has a lot to be learned from. And if you go back to the song of myself, of Whitman, you will find much that is very helpful in pluralistic times, much that is very helpful in divisive times. After all, he was writing on or around the American Civil War. He was writing at a time when many people thought civilization couldn't sink any lower than New York City, and so on down the line. He was also, by the way, a Brooklynite. And one of the lead lines in the Song of Myself is, "Do I contradict myself? Very well, then, I contradict myself. I am large, I contain multitudes." It seems to me that one should think Whitmanesque-like thoughts and operate on Whitmanesque principles, and one will find that the world is infinitely richer and entirely tolerable. Thank you.